Amen. The Norton Lectures are made possible by a generous endowment gift made to the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary by the George W. Norton family of Louisville, Kentucky. They are among the oldest endowed lectures in the theological world and are the oldest lectures in the United States at any institution dedicated to the intersection of science and theology. We welcome you to this first public event, and it is our great pleasure to present to you tonight the 1998 Norton Lecturer. Dr. Philip Johnson is professor of law at the University of California at Berkeley Law School and is well known in the legal world, having a specialization in criminal law. He is an undergraduate alumnus of Harvard College, Harvard University, and he is a graduate of the University of Chicago School of Law. Dr. Johnson, however, is here tonight because he is now among the world's foremost authorities of the issue of naturalistic evolutionism. We invited Dr. Johnson here because he is not only one of the most influential lecturers in this field, but his scholarship, established upon a keen legal mind, has put forth an argument which simply demands to be answered. We welcome Dr. Johnson to the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary for this series of lectures. Many of you know him through his writings, including Darwin on Trial, Reason in the Balance, and Defeating Darwinism. Some of you have read of him in national journals and newspapers, including a recent, very prominent story in the New York Times. Some of you may have seen his firing line debate with William F. Buckley as host just a few weeks ago on public television. I do not want to take any more of his time tonight, as he will now come and deliver the first of the Norton Lectures, and at the conclusion of this lecture, there will be a time for discussion as well. But at this time, let me ask you to join me in welcoming Professor Philip Johnson for the 1998 Norton Lectures.
Thank you. Thank you, folks, for that warm welcome here. You know, I'm new to this part of the country. I don't believe I've been to your city before. I think it's wonderful. So many of you have come out and given such a warm welcome to a foreigner from California, a Presbyterian, a person from a place with the unsavory reputation of Berkeley. So I took some caution in coming here. I have a distant relative who is familiar with this area, and an elderly lady, and I asked her for advice on how to make a good impression on the local people. And she said, when I come to Louisville, and she said, oh, that's what you've got to change right now. She said, it's Louisville, Louisville. And she made me pronounce it several times so I would get it right. So, but President Moeller here just welcomed me to Louisville, so perhaps it's not that important. So, I'm having a wonderful time this month visiting Southern Baptist institutions. It happened at several in a row are on my agenda. I've just been to Dallas and a couple of weeks ago to the Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary there and spoken at a couple of churches. I spoke at one Southern Baptist church, and I had the unique experience. The pastor asked if I would not only deliver the sermon but also the altar call. And so I may be the only elder in the Presbyterian church to have delivered the altar call at a Southern Baptist church. We had not too much success with it, I have to confess. After the first service, nobody came forward, and I felt pretty bad. But after the second service, a little girl about 6 or 7 years old came forward to answer the call. So when they asked afterwards how it had gone, I said, well, I did my best to try to hook a fish, but we only got one, and she was so small we had to throw her back. So I don't know if I'm really up to the big leagues of Southern Baptist preaching. Fortunately, I don't have to preach tonight. I'll be giving you a talk, and then we'll be having a question period. And what I'm going to do in this talk is sort of explain to you how I got into this issue, why I took it up the way I did, and how I size up the issue. This is not going to be heavy on scientific detail. I hope, going to be very understandable to a wide variety of people, because the really important thing with most intellectual issues, not just this one, is not so much to know the answers to every question, but to know the questions to ask, to know what are the right questions to ask. Now, I came to this subject about 10 years ago. I'm an adult convert to Christianity, and I had the good sense to put off my conversion until after I had tenure and even an endowed chair at the University of California. You know how St. Augustine so famously said, "Lord, give me chastity, but not just yet." You say, "Well, wait until I've got tenure, Lord, before asking me to do anything risky." I, at that time, was part of the reason for my conversion had been a disillusionment with the life of a successful academic, with the way in which I saw that we were kind of spinning our wheels, just dealing with words and concepts and not really approaching any kind of a truth. And I had been very disillusioned with the academic success that I had thought previously was my goal in life. And I ended up as a Christian and very interested in the reasons why the academic world and the intellectual world was so resolutely secular or agnostic. In fact, I often like to put it with just a bit of exaggeration. I'll say, if the gospel is true, then why are all the intelligent people agnostics? Well, that's not true. Of course, that's a hyperbole. But all the intelligent people aren't agnostics. But you know why I'd put it that way? Because there's such an overwhelming secular, agnostic, naturalistic cast to the academic mind and the intellectual world, not just in science, but in subjects of every kind, including, by the way, in biblical studies, in theology, that there are seminaries, if you can believe it, that have gone strongly in the naturalistic direction and even had to be reoriented. This is a fact of life in the intellectual world altogether. Now, why is it? See, what makes that to be so taken for granted that even the Christian professors, even the theology professors, will feel an obligation to think in naturalistic terms, in terms that assume that nature is all there is? Well, in the academic year 1987-88, I had the opportunity to go to London on a sabbatical with no teaching duties, just an honorary appointment as a visiting professor at University College in London University, and no real firm idea of a project in mind. I stumbled into a program of reading in Darwinian evolution, became fascinated by the subject and by the assumptions behind the theory of evolution, the scientific difficulties, and the rhetorical tricks with which the theory was advanced. And after a period of time, I became convinced that I saw something, that I understood the answer to my question about the pervasive naturalism in the academic world and what was wrong with evolutionary theory. So I told my wife around the dining table, I said, "I think I understand this issue, but fortunately I'm too smart to take it up professionally, because if I did, I would be in a never-ending series of arguments and trouble. I would be attacked everywhere. People would say, 'You're not a scientist.' It would take over my life. It would become my, you know, this totally devouring thing." So, of course, that was irresistible. And I started the next day. Now, what is it that I saw? It's really quite simple to explain the basic idea. Then there's a lot of development you have to do to fully understand what it means. But the basic idea is that people have been sizing up the question in the wrong way. The world thinks that there's a one particular question, and they've got it wrong. That's not the big issue. There's a different one. So first I'll tell you what the world thinks the question is, that the argument is about, and then I'll tell you what I think it's about. And if you get that distinction and why it's really about the second thing, then you're well on your way to understanding the whole subject. Now, I'll read to you from a typical book of science for the general public to illustrate what the world thinks the argument is about, and then I'll tell you what I think it's about, and then I'll give you some applications of this, and you'll see how it all works out. The world thinks that this is an argument between the Bible and science. That scientists are impartial investigators who make observations and calculations and propose hypotheses and test them with experiments and all of this. And in this impartial, reliable way, they come to knowledge. Well, of course, this isn't altogether false. Scientists definitely do these things, and all of those things are true in a certain area, but not always. And here's what the world thinks the opposition to the theory of evolution that's been developed by this method of scientific investigation is. I quote from a very nice, concise statement of the matter that's from a book by Robert Hazen and James Treffel to science writers called Science Matters, Achieving Scientific Literacy. But there's nothing special about this book. It's like many others I could cite. It says the only opposition to the theory of evolution comes from a certain group of people called biblical creationists. And here's the description of them. Biblical creationists accept on faith the literal Old Testament account of creation. Their beliefs include a young earth, perhaps less than 10,000 years old, catastrophes, especially a worldwide flood as the origin of the earth's present form, and the miraculous creation of all living things, including humans, in essentially their modern forms. Now here comes, I think, the crucial thing. If you are a creationist, the Bible, not nature, dictates what you believe. Creationists subordinate observational evidence to doctrine based on their interpretation of sacred texts. So that's the model of a Bible versus science conflict, and that the creationist position comes from this uncritical adherence to Genesis, literally interpreted, that when creationists make scientific arguments, they are essentially a cover for a position that is actually arrived at strictly on biblical authority so that they ignore any evidence that doesn't fit their preconception. That is, if you're a creationist, the Bible, not nature, dictates what you believe. And so it's the Bible versus science, which amounts to saying that it's the Bible versus the facts. Because science is what our culture trusts to tell us the facts. If the president wants to know how many missiles the Russians have, or if we want to know what causes a disease, or how to cure a disease, or whether there's going to be global warming, we consult the scientific profession, not the Bible. In this view, the biblical creationists are a limited subset of the genus Christian, a limited subspecies, and a very unreasonable one, because if they could just come to terms with the facts, they could go on being Christians as before. Now, I sometimes use various biblical parables to illustrate the world's view of this, and one of my favorites is Matthew 13, 31 to 32, where Jesus says, "The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed, which a man took and sowed in his field, which indeed is the least of all the seeds, but when it's grown, it is greater than the herbs and becomes a tree, so that the birds of the air come and nest in its branches." Now, you're familiar with that, and some of you may know that the parable has been critiqued on scientific grounds in various journals, so that it is said, and I haven't studied this myself, but I'll assume on reliable authority that there is a seed from a type of orchid unknown in Palestine in the first century, which is smaller than the mustard seed. Seed does not really grow into a tree exactly, and that the birds of the air come to eat the mustard seeds rather than to nest. So one can say, well, this isn't the way the botanists would tell a story. Now, the world's view of this is that it's like somebody who said, well, I don't want to hear about your smaller seed. We have the authority of the Bible that the mustard seed is the smallest seed, so I don't want to look through your microscope and see if you've got another seed that's really smaller. So such a person would, of course, be unreasonable. We go to the botanists for information about seeds, and if they thought that it would destroy the authority of Jesus if it turned out that there was a seed smaller than the mustard seed, we would think of them as rather uninspired biblical interpreters, wouldn't we? In fact, everybody that I've ever met, from the strictest biblical creationist would actually agree with that's where you go to find out the information on the seed. So that's the way the world sees that this conflict. It's some unreasonable people who haven't got the right idea of what religion is really about, who get confused with thinking that factual details are the all-important thing, and are prejudiced and won't look at contrary evidence. The way it looks. And of course, once you have that stereotype in place, it is absolutely impossible for the creationists to win an argument. No matter how good their points are, even if they score points on specific issues, which is not at all uncommon. Some big names in science have been seriously embarrassed in debates with creationists. It doesn't really matter, you see, because in the eyes of the world, the creationist approach is just fundamentally wrong. They're using the Bible in the wrong way, and they're ignoring the facts. And even if they score points on particular issues, when it's all over, science is still science, and it's done the same way. And the argument has no lasting effect in that debate. Now, I should say, to avoid giving the wrong impression here about the biblical creationists, of course, they aren't fairly described as a failure either, because they've organized an enormous community within the world of Bible believers, within the Christian world, and that's an impressive accomplishment. But where they're ineffective is in dealing with the general culture for this reason. They're effectively shut out of the mainstream debate. Now, if that's the issue, see, then you can understand why the debate is a non-starter. Now, I became convinced that the real issue is something different than that, and the real question to ask is something different. Because I noticed in my study of evolutionary science that it was fascinating how much difficulty the science was in field after field. How many unfortunate points were coming up, how much the theory had to be continually modified to take account of inconvenient facts, and yet how confident the theory's proponents continued to be that they were basically right. And it was, you know, why is this so? The best known example of this, I could give many and do give many in my writings, I'll just give a single illustration to avoid taking up too much time in this lecture, is the famous or notorious fossil theory of evolution by punctuated equilibria, which really was one of the things that brought my attention to this field. The short of it is that in Darwin's day, his most powerful opponents were not ministers, but fossil experts. And they said, the reason we oppose your theory is that there is no evidence in the fossil record of step-by-step transitions of one thing into something completely different, which you say should have been happening all the time. And why isn't it there? What we see instead is that when new things appear in rocks, they appear fully formed and just as they are, and then they stay fundamentally the same. The evolutionary change is just back and forth variation within the type, not fundamental change into something new, and that contradicts your theory. So Darwin said, well, science is young, we haven't explored many fossil beds, the explanation for this is that the fossil record that we have is very incomplete. So one assumes from that that as it, you know, many new fossil beds are opened up and an enormous amount of exploration goes on, the situation will change. And then we discover around 1980 that the situation is just as bad as it's always been, if not worse. And that despite the fact that the fossil experts have been construing every doubtful case in favor of the theory and admit that they have done this, quotations are in my books, because that's how their careers are made, by finding evidence that fits into the Darwinian paradigm, that as of 1980, the situation is so bad that the leading fossil experts have to propose that the evolution actually occurs in small groups which go off in a corner somewhere, accumulate a lot of mutations, and then come back completely changed. And that this is necessary to assume because, you know, you never see the change happening. As one of these leading paleontologists, Niles Eldridge, the curator of marine invertebrates at the American Museum of Natural History, said, evolution always seems to be going on somewhere else. At least that's how it looks for a poor paleontologist trying to find evidence of it. Now, of course, he means large-scale transformation. There's plenty of evolution that's visible in the sense of back-and-forth variation, but not the transformation. So, and yet, immediately after saying that, saying very frankly that you just don't see the evidence in the record, particularly in the marine invertebrates that Eldridge studies, he says in the very next paragraph that I am a knee-jerk neo-Darwinist. I'm a knee-jerk neo-Darwinist. Now, it's interesting for a scientist to say that he's a knee-jerk anything. See, that's the antithesis of the scientific method and attitude. And to say that he is a knee-jerk neo-Darwinist not because of the evidence in which he's expert, but in spite of it, points out rather dramatically that there's something other than an impartial evaluation of the evidence going on here. So after seeing a number of examples in different areas of this kind of thinking, I became convinced that you had to look to a philosophical explanation to find the real foundations of the theory. And indeed, I determined and wrote to in Darwin on Trial that what we were seeing here is a philosophy called naturalism, evolutionary naturalism, which starts with the assumption that nature is all there is, that nature is made of the particles that physicists study, and that therefore nature had to have the resources to do its own creating. And that once you had this philosophical system in place and used it as the premise for all thinking about the history of life, something more or less like neo-Darwinism follows as a matter of course, regardless of the evidence. That's why Eldridge believes in it, is because he is a philosophical naturalist or materialist, and he has no alternative to get the creating done, other than the Darwinian model and the Darwinian mechanism. And so he believes it in spite of the evidence, because he identifies that with the very definition of science, which is applied naturalistic philosophy. Now, I've developed this argument quite a bit in the writing, too. I know some of you are familiar of it. I found this sort of crowning example, which demonstrates the correctness of this view of the subject, in the January 9th, 1997 issue of the New York Review of Books, where one of the most prominent biologists in the world, Professor Richard Lewontin of Harvard University, wrote a general article on a retrospective, really, of the career of Carl Sagan as a science popularizer, but really more about Lewontin's views of nature of science. He said in that, quite frankly, that he disbelieved the famous just-so stories of Darwinism that are told by Richard Dawkins about how complex organs arise by a combination of random mutations and natural selection. He said that Dawkins' science was based on unsubstantiated and counterfactual statements, which is a sort of an elaborate way of saying something very close to barefaced lies. But that he believed in the evolutionary system anyway, that he believed in the basics of the evolutionary model, in spite of his low opinion of much of the work that is done in this field. And he said, quite frankly, we take this, I quote directly now from his article in the New York Review of Books, we always have to pause at this word, we. I can't go forward without saying, we, you know, you always think of that story about the Lone Ranger and Tonto, when they're surrounded by the Indians, and the Lone Ranger says, what are we going to do, Tonto? And Tonto says, what do you mean, we, pale face? You know, so I always think of that story. It's an old, I'm surprised you haven't heard it, old, but that when I hear that word, we, what do we mean, you know, we? And what he means is the kind of people who read the New York Review of Books and the scientific establishment, the intellectual establishment generally. We take the side of science. In spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs, in spite of the tolerance of the scientific community for unsubstantiated just-so stories, you see, that's the Darwinian accounts, because we have a prior commitment, a commitment to materialism. Now, by materialism, he means the same thing that I meant when I used the word naturalism. It's the same thing. Nature's all there is, and nature's made of matter. We have a prior commitment, a commitment to materialism. It is not that the methods and institutions of science somehow compel us to accept a material explanation of the phenomenal world, but on the contrary, that we, that word again, are forced by our a priori adherence to material causes to create an apparatus of investigation and a set of concepts that produce material explanations, no matter how counterintuitive, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated. Moreover, that materialism is absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. Now, that's telling it like it is. And I've always said, I love this that paragraph. I'd love to have it set to music. It so marvelously captures that materialist viewpoint. Because Lewontin, a materialist and a Marxist himself, thinks that the alternative to this materialistic understanding of reality is a completely irrational universe in which events happen for no particular reason because capricious spirits cause them to happen. See, that's what he thinks of as the alternative to materialism, is this kind of superstitious, animistic world. And I know that a great many scientific materialists and people in the academic world do actually think that way. It's a paradoxical situation, you see. The universe can be rational in their view, rationally comprehensible, only if it is the product of irrational causes, matter in mindless motion. But if it is the product of a great mind, it must be irrational. Now, there's thinking for you. That's what we spend $35,000 a year to go to Harvard to learn. I greatly admired this article because it was so honest. And then when you understand it that way, that it is the a priori commitment, the prior commitment, the beginning of the inquiry, before you read the evidence, to materialism or naturalism that governs, so then everything becomes clear that's previously unclear. Why is it that a simple instance of variation, as in the famous peppered moth observations, where there's sometimes more peppered moths that are light-colored and sometimes more that are dark-colored in the population, why is this presented in the books as a proof that natural selection can make moths in the first place, as well as the scientific observers who observe the moths and the birds who eat them? Why does a book called The Beak of the Finch, published in 1994, get enormously favorable reviews in all the mainstream journals and won the Pulitzer Prize, I believe, for presenting evidence that there is a slight variation, 3 to 5% from year to year, in the average size of finch beaks among a population of finches in an island in the Pacific? Well, why do the scientists who measure these beaks of finches, a rather dull trade, if you ask me, every year for 20 years, why do they get a television special done on their work, and they're lionized as great scientists? Well, you see, because it shows natural selection doing something. The finch beaks vary due to environmental changes, or that's the theory. So the large beaks are a little bit better to have in one set of conditions and smaller ones in others, and this affects the average in the population. It shows natural selection doing something, and there's so very few examples of it doing anything at all. And if you know that natural selection has to be responsible for all the creating anyway, then you're very readily satisfied by what seems to an outsider like extremely scanty and inadequate evidence. So we understand now why these experiments and observations become so famous far beyond their actual scientific merit. Why weren't Stephen Jay Gould and Niles Eldridge, the fossil experts, at all upset to find that the fossil record is un-Darwinian after, you know, well more than a century of desperate efforts to construe it in Darwinian terms, so that they had to take this desperate, you know, measure of punctuated equilibria? Why didn't this make them doubt that the basic evolutionary theory was correct? Well, again, you see, what they are really convinced of is that materialism is true. Therefore, they have nowhere else to go and must find an explanation for why all the evidence is hidden. Why don't the fossil experts, in fact, ask themselves the question that I have asked? They say that the evidence for evolutionary transitions isn't any better than it is because the fossil record is incomplete. That was Darwin's claim, and it's still the major claim that's made today. The theory of the punctuated equilibria theory is a minority position in the field. So we say, well, the fossil record's incomplete. But if you look at the cases in which possible transitional forms have been identified, it turns out that they are practically all in the vertebrate series, among vertebrate animals, land animals, where the fossil record is the most incomplete. But whereas in marine invertebrates, which Niles Eldridge specializes in, they live in the shallow seas. They get covered over with sediments when they die, so there are lots of fossils of them, millions and millions. And it is there that the fossil record is most determinedly un-Darwinian. So it's just variations and so on. Now, why don't they, you know, draw the obvious conclusion that it isn't the incompleteness of the fossil record that is the problem? Well, where would you go with it if you did? In the origin of life, if you read journals on chemical evolution theories, that is supposed to have led non-living chemicals to organize themselves into living organisms, you'll find that there's a sort of a boosterism, an optimism in the people who are writing grant proposals, who are in the field. And that's easy to understand. You know, you don't get a grant by telling the granting agency that you're getting nowhere. But if you look at the evaluations of it by scientists who are well aware of the field, you know, in related areas and so on, they will tell you the experiments are going nowhere. Nobody knows what even the right starting point is. Every theory has a few adherents and, you know, many, many detractors, and they're clearly getting nowhere with this experimental evidence. And yet, if you read these pieces, you will still see that they feel that success is nonetheless just around the corner. When Carl Sagan learned that the period in which life could have evolved is much shorter than had previously been thought to exist, because the fossils evidence of life is said to go back almost 4 billion years, in fact some say even more than that now, to a period when the Earth was constantly bombarded by comets and meteors and so on, and conditions were utterly inhospitable for life. So the amount of time where it, you know, could possibly have appeared in the conditions available is quite short, geologically speaking, a few million years. Sagan said what he concluded from this was that obviously the chemical evolution of life from non-life must be much easier than we had thought because it happened in so brief a time. So it did not affect his faith an iota. Similarly, with all of the enormously powerful objections that have been made to the Darwinian system, we can see again that it is the philosophy that necessarily carries it through. The trump card which they can use on opponents is always the same. What is your alternative? If your alternative is, well, God did it, God is outside of science, you see, that violates the definition of science as applied naturalistic philosophy, applied materialism. And if you say, we don't know, that violates the rules too, because we have a paradigm in place, you can improve it, but we don't go back to scratch and start over. And above all, we don't want to give support, and this is sometimes said very frankly, even in public, but mostly behind closed doors, we want to don't want to do anything which gives any support whatsoever to those vile people, the creationists, say the class enemy. Now, at this point, I'll add one more observation. This also explains why the naturalistic method tends to spill across into other subjects like history and like biblical studies, because the scientific method is the way we find the facts. So if we're going to find the facts about the Bible, the quest for the historical Jesus, you know, the origins of Genesis and so on, we will have a naturalistic and evolutionary perspective for that. So the same intellectual method is used everywhere. So now this suggests that there's a way to reframe the issue that changes the debate completely. And that's what I've been trying to do. Because the question should not be, should we follow the Bible or science? See, that's a misleading question that just leads us into a cul-de-sac that's going nowhere. The question should be, should we follow the evidence of our observations and experiments, or should we follow materialistic philosophy, regardless of the evidence? Richard Lewontin says pretty clearly that the answer to that is that we follow the philosophy. See, that's the a priori, that's the prior commitment. And that if the evidence is going in one direction and the philosophy is going in the other, so much the worse for the evidence. We can see this acted out in the reception which a number of leading scientists have given to the work of my friend and colleague Michael Behe, B-E-H-E, the biochemist from Lehigh University in Pennsylvania, who has written a book, Darwin's Black Box, that's sold extremely well, gotten a lot of attention, about the irreducible complexity of molecular systems. Behe describes the intricate machines that make up our bodies and those of all other living organisms. The cell, which in Darwin's time was thought to be a blob of some jelly-like substance, turns out to be vastly more complex than any human creation, any spaceship or computer, and its new levels of complexity are brought out, you know, with each new level of discoveries. And the complexity is such that it requires many components all working together, and none of the components does anything useful unless they're all in place. And Behe cites example after example of this. And so it is impossible to design a credible scenario in which a mindless process builds these systems up one part at a time. That's what irreducible complexity means. Now, Behe's scientific description is absolutely standard. You can read it in lots of other, you know, molecular books and, you know, parts and places here. I just read an article by Bruce Alberts, the president of the National Academy of Sciences, about molecular machines that reads like it was written by Michael Behe. But it is a matter of faith among all those other scientists that nonetheless the Darwinian system somehow made them, never mind how. We'll figure it out someday. And so the reviews of Behe have tended to say he's got the facts right, but what he's writing isn't science, because he makes the unforgivable leap. He says that the reality of irreducible complexity points to the reality of a designer. And a designer would be something outside of science, which science cannot comprehend, cannot control, and that is unthinkable. We cannot allow the divine foot in the door, because then the whole game is over. Well, so that's the question, and that's the question that I want to present. Which do we follow, the philosophy or the facts? Now, this method of explaining it will tell you why I keep such a very careful distance from any of the biblical issues, why I will not respond to questions that say, you know, what do you think about the days of Genesis, or other issues of the general nature of how do we reconcile the biblical text with the scientific evidence, or what we know or what we think we know from science. The way I answer all of those questions is they're premature. that there's no point in comparing the Bible with a science which isn't true, or conforming it to that. The science that we have is too infected with this materialist philosophy. The job for today is to separate the philosophy from the genuine science, that is to say, the evidence, and find out what the possibilities are that are consistent with the evidence. And we have to do that job a step at a time. We can't do it all in advance, and a law professor can't stand up and do it, you know, off the top of his head. It's the job of an entire research program. So we have to make the first start in the right way. And it is absolutely no way to get that job done to start telling people what the answers are going to be. See, that has to be open. And of course, as soon as the university world, as the secular world, hears the word Bible, the minds snap shut. See, then they know what they think, and they think that we should stay right where we are. So it's very necessary to keep that whole range of issues outside. Obviously, the day will come when they will reemerge. But for present purposes, the thing is to get science on the right track. And so it is my practice to avoid anything that gets in the way of doing that. Now, how are we going to change this situation? What's the strategy for bringing about a change? I've already described to you a large part of that. It's to focus on the right question. You see, it's not to get ourselves trapped in the Bible science stereotype, but to put the pressure on the other side. Which do we follow? The evidence that's pointing towards design, that's pointing away from Darwinism, or the philosophy which supports Darwinism, and to get the issue widely understood that way. That makes the issue one which is clearly legitimate on the mainstream academic stage. See, it's the kind of issue that they can understand. People are very resistant to it because they're afraid of what will happen if they allow it out of the bag. But it's the kind of thing that people do in the academic world all the time, critique the philosophical foundations of somebody's system. All the techniques that I use are very common in the academic world, except you see that they're not commonly used against the great sacred cow. That is held sacrosanct from them. So this is a way of making the issue a legitimate one, getting it on the academic stage, and then, of course, once people get to see that there are arbitrary assumptions and so on, then you begin to get the academic game played, and it's no longer sacred. It's no longer a sacred theory. So this is what I try to do in the secular university world. Now, in the Christian world, the problem is to find a way to get people to understand the issue properly and to ask the right questions and to develop a position which tends to make allies and to unify people. A major reason why the Christians have never been able to get anywhere with this issue or with many others is that they have been immersed in sectarian divisions and concerns. And you can see this with this issue. You see, when the creation evolution issue comes up, the Catholics say it's a Protestant issue. Say, we don't care about the Genesis authority, we care about the magisterium, the church authority, and we can handle anything. Say, we can work with these things on a philosophical basis, and so we don't feel it's our issue. The Jews, the God-believing Jews I'm speaking of now, will say, well, it's a Christian, you know, thing, and they're a danger. Within the Protestant world, you have, of course, the liberals who are actually naturalistic in their thinking anyway, and I think are just very much on the other side. But among the conservative Protestants, you will have the division over things like the age of the earth and the right way to interpret Genesis. And pretty soon, everybody's fighting everybody. And this means that the agnostics, the philosophical naturalists, are able to continue their rule. And in a large sense, I think that they deserve to continue to rule. You see, if they can produce a unified and coherent governing principle and nobody else can, then in a sense, their rule is legitimate. So I put the issue as, is God real? Is the Creator real? And that's the same issue, you see, as the should we follow the philosophy or the evidence. Does the evidence point to the reality of a creator, or doesn't it? Whatever scientists may want to do for their own purposes, should we outsiders as citizens be required to assume that materialism is true because people like Richard Lewontin happen to like it? I say, well, the answer to that is obvious. No. If the issue becomes one of philosophy, then do biologists as biologists have a particular authority to resolve it for us? Obviously, no. And you see, these are points that one can agree on across a wide spectrum of theological differences on other questions. I never urge or preach a false ecumenism in which people give up their deeply held beliefs for strategic purposes, or in which you get this merger of power figures at the top, or whatever. What I do think, however, is that people of differing theological views should learn to recognize who's relatively close to them and who's relatively distant, should learn to make allies and friends and work together with them, and to hold divisive issues back when it is not the proper time and place to raise them, to have a sense of priorities. I love to say with people who take a strong position on the age of the earth or something that I'm putting aside, I love to say to them, you know, after we've settled the issue of the reality of the Creator, after we've got that firmly established on the table, we'll have a wonderful argument about the age of the earth. And it'll be loads of fun, it'll be the time we can then talk about it. We'll be able to approach the subject like that much more intelligently when we have a level playing field. And we have some idea of what the real scientific knowledge is, and we will approach it in a different spirit when we have had the experience of working together for a common goal. We will be changed and changed for the better by that experience. And I find that this pitch is very widely and readily accepted. I have developed a very good and friendly and close relations across the spectrum of people that deal with this, from the articles in the Southern Baptist journals that have recently been appearing. I've been the subject of profiles in the Eastern Orthodox Church. I have a publication coming out any day now in Commonweal, a relatively liberal Catholic journal, which solicited it. Michael Behe, one of my closest associates, is a Roman Catholic. And of course, William F. Buckley sponsored us on PBS television. Father Richard Newhouse of First Things, a Roman Catholic, is one of my main publishers. Across the Protestant denominations, there have been, you may know, a lot of tensions between people like Hugh Ross and Henry Morris of the Institute for Creation Research. Both of them sell and promote my books, and I'm on excellent terms with both because I'm trying to achieve a position, you see, which all of the people from this can regard as legitimate. And this is really the key to advancement. You know, if you ask why the agnostics came in and took over the universities, they're not to blame. They were given away. They moved into a vacuum. Christian thinkers abandoned the intellectual territory and were more concerned with divisive issues and fighting with each other. And we've simply got to learn to get over that. And without denying the important divisions that exist, learn always to approach them in a healthy way. Now, what I'm hoping to see grow out of this, a reason why it's important for me to come to institutions like this to speak to the public and to speak especially to the membership and leaders of denominations like the Southern Baptists, is to help promote a sense, which I think many people already have and just needs to be encouraged, that it's really time for the Christians to re-engage with the life of the mind. That there has been a tendency to retreat from the intellectual world. In the 20th century, Christianity has done a reasonably good job with the heart. We have those Billy Graham rallies, and we have Campus Crusade meeting with the undergraduates on the college, and you know, many other things that are really spectacular examples and advances for which the people responsible deserve every credit. But they have basically spoken to the heart, to what people's emotional, spiritual needs, and the intellectual world has been captured by the materialists, the naturalists, the agnostics, in which they have dominated, and even come out of the secular world to take a heavy influence in the Christian educational institutions. The reason that this has been possible is that they have grabbed the high metaphysical ground, I would say. You see, they have said, we know what reality really is like. Nature's all there is. Nature did its own creating. God is a part of the human imagination. It's not the case that God created man. It's the other way around. Man created God. Not knowing that evolution is our true creator, primitive human beings imagined this father figure in the sky. And religion is a human phenomenon. And in place of God, that imaginary figure, we have religious belief, which really exists, and which we study in departments of religious studies, where we put the Christian myth alongside the Eskimo myths and the Patagonian myths and so on, and treat them equally. And this is the way that it's proper to proceed in these matters. Now, you know, even people who are in their personal life very serious and genuine Christians have often been influenced by that because they've heard it all their lives in these educational institutions, and they almost unconsciously will come to terms with it or retreat from it, and in either case are unable to engage effectively in the intellectual world. If the truth of the reality of God is to have a place in the intellectual world, it has to be asserted as a genuine reality, as the foundation for truths of all other kinds. And so we're mounting and trying to create an entire intellectual movement in discipline after discipline that is turning this from simply an argument into a broad-gauged intellectual program. Young people growing up in the next generation are going to have a great opportunity to participate in that kind of program. They're going to have a great opportunity to go to secular colleges and universities or Christian colleges and universities and have something important to say, have some confidence about meeting the intellectual arguments with success because they understand where the bad ideas are coming from and why people think they're true and why they really aren't true. So if we have the imagination and the courage to do this, we can do a wonderful thing for our young people by preparing them to engage in this kind of work of the mind. And everybody can make a contribution. If you happen to be the kind of person with a gift for the cutting edge intellectual work, that's wonderful, but that's a minority. Not most people don't have that. But all kinds of teachers, pastors, parents, and all of that can help in their own way to bring this along. And I think it's a great a work, perhaps what the Great Commission most means in our day. Because you know, we're coming to the end of a period. We're coming rapidly to the end of the 20th century, the century of Darwin, Marx, and Freud as its great intellectual makers, the century of the death of God, a century of the domination of materialist philosophy all over the world in its different manifestations. We're even coming to the end of more than that. As you know, we're coming to the end of a millennium. And these errors, these heresies, these follies of human thought don't last forever. They run their course. And now it appears that the 20th century is running its course. Marx has lost all of his scientific standing. Freud has lost all of his scientific standing. Darwin still remains, but for those who know, the foundations are extremely shaky and ready to fall as soon as the right kind of push can be made. So that's what I see as the great task of the coming generation, to give that push, to do it in the right way, with the right weapons, with the principles of intellectual honesty and freedom of thought at the fore, and with a determination to use the victory to bring intellectual life to a far better state on a far surer foundation. Instead of building on the sand of naturalistic assumptions that are not in accord with the way things really are, to build on the foundation of the mind in whose image we were created and whose rationality is what makes it possible for us to understand the world even as well as we do. So that's what I'm up to. That's why I'm here. Thanks very much for coming to hear me. And now we'll take the questions. If you want to ask a question, the rule is you have to come to the microphone because they're recording here. And so speak clearly into the microphone, then you'll be part of posterity here as this is recorded. Oh, wow. It always takes a moment to break the ice before the I'm always glad for the first person because it all, you know, becomes easy for people after that.
I wanted to thank you for coming. I was present at your debate at UC Irvine when you debated Rose, and I was...
That was a terrible debate.
Well, I thought you did good.
Oh. I'll tell you about that in a moment.
Okay. Yeah. I'd like to hear it. If evolution was held up by three pillars, we're making its foundation... what things would you say to knock down those pillars, and could you put those in priority?
Well, how do we knock down the pillars? I'm just going to mention to this group, he was referring to a debate that I remember with pain that occurred at the University of California at Irvine campus. They had about 2,000 people there. And a really prominent scientist named Michael Rose, not to be confused with Michael Ruse, who I've also debated, and who's in the news much now. He claims to have identified the gene for aging, and you can make people live longer if you do something with it. And this fellow, he was the dirtiest debater I've ever seen. He said absolutely nothing, you know. But he had the final thing, and at the last rebuttal, he took a prepared speech out of his pocket and read it. You see, so that I wouldn't have an opportunity to respond to anything he said. It was just a cheap trick. But it really was a very peculiar debate. Anyway, it's the only time anybody's ever done anything like that to me. But the pillars of Darwinism and what you do, well, what I'm saying is that the key thing is to turn it into the philosophical issue, you see, and the basic thinking issue. What you can't do, the way you can't win the argument, is to get involved in the scientific detail. Because, you see, that's for specialists. And one of the things that goes wrong when you get a young person who comes into college and they've read some of the anti-Darwinian or creationist literature, you see, and so they know some of the arguments, and they'll start arguing with the professor, and the professor always has more facts. And in fact, the professor, and I happen to know this well, can also bluff if he doesn't know what he's talking about. And will sound, you know, if you can say it confidently enough, it'll sound like you do. So the kid's bound to lose the argument that way. So what you have to do is get down to the level of the basic thinking assumptions and what you're saying, and know the right questions to ask. You know, professor, that, you know, peppered moth, is that the best evidence of the creative power of natural selection we have, or do you know of something better? See that, and you know, so, and that's another thing. So know how to ask the right questions. But in terms of the high intellectual work of this, as opposed to students going into classes and all, you see, what we're trying to do, I'm encouraging the scientists who are willing to take up this issue to get involved in a number of areas. And we'll be coming out with books in the next few years that I think are really going to have an effect. A mathematician and philosopher named William Dembski is coming out from Cambridge University Press in England. And that and another book that we're doing are about the legitimacy of design as a concept in science and, you know, helping to legitimate that in the high academic world. We have another book that'll be coming out that's based on a PhD dissertation that was recently approved at the University of Chicago on what is called on embryology or development, on the development of the embryo in the womb, and this is a fascinating area. You know, Darwinians have always claimed embryology as an evidence of evolution. That the human embryo is supposed to have gill slits. You hear that and go through the fish stage. It's fictional. And indeed, textbooks in embryology. I don't have a good slide here or something to show you this, but many of you have probably seen this in textbooks. The the drawings of vertebrate embryos in which you see that they all look a little bit alike at supposedly the earliest stages, you see, and that's supposed to illustrate how they had the common ancestor. The drawings are forgeries, were made in the 19th century, and they're still used in spite of the fact they've been known for long. And this I'm holding this up from a recent expose of this from August 1997 in the London Sunday Times, which is based on scientific papers. I mean, it's not a newspaper expose. It's a newspaper story about a scientific expose. But it's, in fact, been known for a century. And yet they sort of still show there. And in fact, what we've learned about embryology and development, I won't go into it now, but it's radically inconsistent with the whole Darwinian scheme of what it must be like. So in area after area, you see, we're bringing up these issues one after another. But now, for reasons I've already explained, you can't win the argument on any one of these, because as long as the way of thinking is in place, it doesn't matter. But when we combine this with a broad-based attack on the way of thinking and a campaign to reach and educate the public, then I think we've got something really going. So that's how we plan to do this. Yes, sir, would you step up to the microphone?
You know, Old Testament, people lived to be 900 some odd years old, and they'll say their months and years were different, but I believe the world's been in this, turning the same since God created it. What's your answer on that?
Well, of course, the longevity of the patriarchs of the Old Testament is exactly one of those issues that I don't touch, but for reasons that I've already explained. Did it happen or didn't it? However, I will tell you that I'm about to review for First Things a book by a prominent physicist at a university in Israel who's written about this. And there's a development of something really fascinating, which I can only call Jewish creation science. And he has a view about how to reconcile the days of Genesis with the Big Bang cosmology through the time dilation. It turns out, according to him, that if you consider the fact that time runs slower under conditions of extreme gravitational pressure and all, that's standard relativity doctrine, I at least know that much, then 6 days is measured under the conditions of quark confinement at the beginning of the Big Bang turns out to be proportional to 16 billion years of Earth time as we experience it. I was kind of fascinated by that. And he defends the ages of the patriarch on the view that the cosmic ray conditions were entirely different and there were many fewer mutations, and so aging operated entirely different. Well, I have no opinion on that. I have enough trouble as it is with the issues that I do deal with. But others have something to say about that, and that's fine with me. Once you get into that, of course, you see the reason why I don't want to get into it, because then you're in a debate on that subject and you're going nowhere. You see, it just bogs you down.
Yeah. I'm a freshman at Pierre B. Askell, and recently in my biology class we're studying evolution and Darwinism, and my biology teacher gave us a pamphlet to read, and we had to respond to certain parts of the pamphlet.
It gave you a what?
Like a pamphlet on evolution and stuff.
Oh, a pamphlet, yeah.
That biologists had wrote, and we were supposed to write down on a piece of paper on the certain parts of the pamphlet if we agreed or disagreed and explained why. And on one of the questions I wrote, I do not believe that this statement is true. I strongly disagree with it because evolution is just a theory, and even scientists say that themselves. There is no proof that evolution ever took place, and I believe that God created the world and heavens, not that we evolved from some primordial scum or something. I believe that the creation theory is a complete and coherent account of living things.
Well, you were asking for trouble, weren't you?
he responded that... if this was true, that he asked me if I'd rather use a Bible on my next exam than my biology book, and he put down that he didn't think so, and then what is the proof of creation, and that it's just a belief, it's not a theory. And I was wondering what I could say to him to, I guess, get him to kind of quit picking on people who believed in God and creation.
Well, you know, it's an interesting problem about how to approach a problem like this. I think it's a very good thing for young people in high school or college, you know, to learn a lot about what evolutionary theory is. And it's really unprofessional for the teacher to ask, if this is exactly what he did, do you believe in it? You know, the sort of the questions of do you believe in it? The proper questions that he should be asking are, do you understand what it is? And I would suggest that that's an approach that, you know, you sort of might take, because the teacher is I think quite within his rights in saying that you should, you know, it's they're teaching you what evolutionary theory is, and you should know something about it. In fact, what I always say is I want people to learn a whole lot more about it than the teachers want you to know. But you should certainly learn, you know, what it is that they are teaching and what the theory is, and then he's entitled to, you know, give a test to show whether you've learned it or not. But whether you believe it, you see, is another question. That isn't, I think, strictly speaking, a proper one. And that is one which, you know, I think a student can make often with considerable effect, because that's simply, you know, bringing up the professionalism. The way in which I think it's probably most productive to answer this is this is a way of thinking that might have some validity if you make certain assumptions about the world. You see, I'm telling you what the assumptions are, some people are calling these things into question, and it may be that there'll be a re-examination of this, and we won't be so sure in the future. I would tend to favor making a cautious statement like that, rather than bringing out the big artillery and saying, you know, I want to debate the whole issue of the Bible or whatever. Again, that is, I think, more likely to make a start towards opening the subject up rather than arousing a defensive reaction. So without, you know, in any way criticizing what you've done, because you've shown a great deal of courage and arguing for what you're true, and I heartily approve of that, without giving away your position, you see, to make a more kind of modest skepticism about it might be something worth trying, since you ask for my advice.
Besides the fact that you now have tenure, and so you have some level of protection, as you alluded to in your opening remarks, can you talk a little bit more about the situations that have arisen in some circumstances as you've battled in the secular university in contending for the views that you have, because I would imagine that you have been strongly opposed on every front. Secondly, can you speak for a minute about the discovery publicized last week about the Madagascar link between the dinosaur and the bird?
Yes, I can answer both of those. I always, when the question of tenure comes up, that's a bit of an aside. I do like to tell people that tenure is a bit overrated, particularly from the standpoint of a Berkeley professor. We have a lifelong merit system, you see, and you get tenure as an associate professor, but if you are an associate professor for life at Berkeley, you're miserable. You're labeled a failure. When you get to be a full professor, there are 9 steps in the full professor series, and then an above scale above that. And they're always dangling a carrot in front of you, you see, and it's a highly, it's a place where the people want to be, you know, recognized as at the top. So you don't really, you know, have quite the security you might think in that sense, although they won't fire you. The problem with scientists in raising issues like this, and the reason why a scientist, a biologist, really would not be doing this, is that the real hold over them is the grant money. You see, again, they wouldn't fire a tenured professor or whatever, you would stop getting grants from the granting agencies if you get off the reservation too far. Because, see, these are peer-reviewed anonymously, and you start getting unfavorable reviews, and you're just out. So they're very timid about this, because if you don't have grant money, you don't have anything. You don't have a lab, and you're not really in science at all. Clearly, if I had tried to do all of this work while I was trying to get evaluated, you know, for tenure and all of that, the university would, I think, fairly understandably have said, this isn't what we appointed you to do. You see, and it isn't your field and all of that. And so there would have been a genuine problem of academic evaluation without regard to you know, anything that you could plainly label an academic freedom violation in that. So that's really why I had to be a senior professor. Now, the reactions as I try to raise these issues are all over the place. You know, I mean, I've been treated, the geology department, the University of Oklahoma, treated me as an honored guest. I spent all day there, seminars, a program for the faculty and so on. You know, at other places, I've been shown the door, you know, or, you know, they sort of won't have me there. It depends on the individuals and, you know, how nervous they are or how defensive and so on. It's very hard to get the biologists to approve anything, but you see, I will often come in through the philosophy department or some discipline allied like that into a major university, and then a couple of biologists will be lured into, you know, the debate or a seminar or discussion or whatever. I've succeeded in publishing in a number of the journals. In terms of the secular universities, there's been a huge difference since Michael Behe's book came out, because Behe has the union card, you see, as a grant-receiving, practicing, I hope he's going to be still a grant-receiving, we'll have to wait and see, molecular biologist, you see, with all the lab work and so on. And so he is accepted at the scientific meetings in a way in which I couldn't be. It's slow work working against the grain, but I do go to university after university, and I won't go unless I get some degree of official academic sponsorship. See, when a Christian groups try to bring me in, I say I want a front door invitation. I don't want to come in by the servant's entrance, you know, invited by just a student group or whatever, but with departmental sponsorship and that kind of thing. And it's regularly arranged one way or another. The University of Texas at Austin, the philosophy department, with a couple of sympathetic philosophers, put on a whole three-day conference on my work. You know, invited 100 professors with papers and all of that. While I was there for that conference, amazing thing happened. The University of Texas, for some reason, has been particularly good territory for me. I gave a public lecture, you know, sort of like this one, in their largest hall, 1,000 people came. And the dean of the law school, a Jewish unbeliever, as he identified himself, gave the introduction to my talk, and I was simply blown away when he told the people there that he thought this was the most important thing they'd hear all year, because this was the issue that was being suppressed, you know, in the academic community. Well, for somebody in his position to say something like this, you know, is just really remarkable, and, you know, just was a wonderful thing. The president of the University of Minnesota came and introduced me at my a talk there. Both of these are people I've known for years in the law school world, you see, and that helps a lot to be personally known and connected. So we gradually build this up as a legitimate academic movement with programs like that, and it takes time. But that's how it's going. I'm quite pleased with the progress that we're making. Yes, Jim.
I was wondering how you respond to Christians who would say to you, and I know they have said to you, it seems to us that the way you present things means people who don't believe in God are Darwinists and naturalists and that sort of thing. Those who do believe in God would question the underpinnings and such. We are Christians. We are Darwinists. Do you try to help them understand the conflict in their opinions? Do you try to help them see the difficulty of holding both? How do you respond to that kind of person? Because I know you've had to.
Yes, that's a very good question. And of course, as you know, I have a lot of experience with that, just exactly that a problem. Now, certainly it is the case that lots of people hold views that are inconsistent with each other. This is very common. I say, it may be even mentally healthy to a certain extent, for all I know, you know, not to be completely of one piece. So you will certainly find people who are absolutely terrific Christians in many respects who don't understand this issue, and you know, don't understand why they shouldn't be Darwinists or whatever. I have a really dear friend who's a biology professor. who is one of the finest, you know, Christians that I know, and, you know, very genuine in every way, and he's just hopeless on this issue. He really can't see what, you know, what the problem is, and I think he doesn't want to see it. So, this is human nature, you know, so it doesn't mean that somebody isn't a terrific a Christian. I'm certainly not making any judgment about that. What my work is really much more about is why the Christians have been marginalized, you see, in the intellectual world. Good a Christian as this friend of mine I have in mind is, you see, he has all these private virtues and Sundays and in the lab during the week too, and it doesn't reflect anything on his intellectual work or scientific work, and where he goes along sort of with everybody else. The Scientific American did a story a couple months ago, about Francis Collins, the head of the Human Genome Project, who is an evangelical Christian, and to the best of my knowledge, a very genuine one. But see, the story was headlined, Francis Collins tries to keep his religion from interfering with his scientific work. And say words to that effect. Now, nobody says Richard Lewontin tries to keep his atheism, you know, from interfering with his scientific work. So, you know, these people say, oh, it's possible to be a good Christian and a scientist, you know, possible. See, but it's remarkable. Nobody says, gosh, you're a good scientist and an atheist? How remarkable? How do you manage it? It's the marginalization in the intellectual world. I will say that one of the things that really energized me on this issue early on, many years ago, even before I went to England for that visit, as a new Christian, I was at one of these meetings that the parachurch organizations put on where they get some faculty members to speak and so on. And they had the half dozen Christian faculty in Berkeley who were willing to identify themselves. In fact, it may have been fewer than that. But one by one, they get up, and as you should see, they're mostly engineering professors. And so you have a lot of people in applied science and all. And then there was this biochemist and so on. And they all say, well, what does being a Christian mean to you? You know, well, we're nice to students. We're compassionate. You know, we follow the golden rule, whatever. But it had nothing to do with their intellectual work. Well, that was okay, because I didn't know exactly what these folks were supposed to do different because they were Christians either. But when the professor of English literature got up and gave the same line, I hit the roof. I said, I mean, you know, here's a place where you've got every ideology in the world, feminist, deconstructionist, radical Marxist, you know, and so on. And how can you say, you know, that you don't approach things differently in that area because of this? And but you see, that's the academic world. That you know that the boundaries. So that's really what happens. And you see, if you accept the view that the right way to understand the world is a naturalistic way, then you are, as a Christian, naturally going, or a theist of any kind. I mean, this would go for a non-Christian theist as well. You're on the intellectual defensive, you're apologetic about it. And you really have the burden of sort of showing that it hasn't ruined you academically, and they all feel this, you know, this is very, very widely felt. Now you see, on the other hand, if God is real and nature isn't all there is, and this whole Darwinian system is based on an illusion, then who's supposed to be intellectually on the defensive? So it's really that. But I definitely don't mean to suggest or insinuate that people who hold a very different opinion from me on these issues wouldn't necessarily be as good or better, you know, Christians in many important respects as a person who agrees with me or myself. Yes.
Could you go back to the Madagascar question?
Oh, yeah, I forgot to answer it.
And then also, could mm-hmm. you describe what is the most frustrating and enjoyable things about engaging in these types of debates?
Sure. First to the bird. I just forgot that. You know, these things are being found all the time. What the find is, as I recall, is a bird with claws, and I think it looks something like a dinosaur. The whole issue of whether birds evolved from dinosaurs is being fought out in a big cat fight among the experts anyway. Some say it's practically established. Others say it's ridiculous. The reason, you know, dinosaur skeletons are rather like bird skeletons. So if you assume that birds evolved from something, you know, dinosaurs are a reasonable candidate for it, but then there are lots of difficulties in terms of the age and so on. So another specimen has been found. Now, all of this is beside the point to me. You see, you have to look at the fossil evidence as a whole, and with the main questions in mind. How do you make a bird? You see, how do you make the complex organs and all of that? What's the designing mechanism and so on? We always come back to that. That's the key issue. And it really doesn't tell us anything about that. So I don't, you know, find those sort of terribly important, these finds that come in and out and are, you know, changing all the time. The fossil record as a whole is wildly inconsistent with Darwinian expectations and with the validity of that crucial mechanism of the accumulation of micromutations through natural selection that has to do the designing. Now, on my experience and what I find encouraging and discouraging, I think some of the biggest surprises to me have been in the religious reaction. Now, because I'm an adult convert, I don't come out of the Christian culture at all. That is really makes a difference, you know, I've discovered. And when I first got out and started arguing this, people told me, they said, now, watch out for those fundamentalists, you see. They will stab you in the back. They're a really nasty crew because you aren't defending the young earth, you see, in the full Genesis position and so on. So you won't be popular there. But then there are all these nice academics, you see, and the theistic evolutionists and so on. That's your crowd. And you should go and, you know, get along with them. This turned out to be just the reverse of that. I have found that, in fact, my relationship with the fundamentalists or with people that are called fundamentalists in the, you know, the secular community and all of that has tended to be excellent. Such differences of, you know, opinion on particular issues or strategies as they are just that, you know, the normal thing of human intercourse and handled in a perfectly friendly and even a genial way. The theistic evolutionists in the Christian academic world have been tremendously defensive in many cases, not all. That, you know, these are generalities and they don't necessarily apply to every individual. Some Christian college professors have really move strongly into my camp and group and are very valued. But there has been a sense, and a part of many, that this is absolutely the wrong issue to raise, that what they are trying to do is distance themselves from fundamentalism and save Christianity by making it academically, you know, respectable, intellectually respectable, and that you can put all of this together and it's no problem unless you have troublemakers, you see, like me. And so sometimes the resistance there is very bitter and personally, you know, and antagonistic in a way. Now, that's been, you know, a bit of a disappointment, but, you know, just something to work with. And my view is I never back away from a situation like that or cut people off. You know, I come back to those very institutions where I've had, you know, that kind of a response, and we just work at it again, and eventually we'll work through it. Because you got to, these are tough issues, and people are going to feel strongly about them. Now, with respect to the secular world, of course, when I meet atheists and so on in the fur flies, I'm not surprised. You see, they're mad and so on, so we deal with that. I would say, however, that while I occasionally get people who are really nasty, I had a dinner at Cornell with Carl Sagan and his wife, and they behaved like you know, barbarians. It was just terrible. They were so, you know, hostile and totally unwilling to, you know, I don't know why they agreed to have dinner with me. Because I think he must have felt terribly threatened to have behaved that way. It was so unprofessional. And I've had other occasions like that, but I would say they're rare. The more normal thing is like with Will Provine, who is my host at Cornell, who's as atheistic as Carl Sagan and so on, and we've, you know, sort of become buddies out of it, or with Michael Ruse, one of the leading Darwinian debaters. You know, I took him and his wife out to dinner when I was in Canada last, and we sort of had a wonderful time. It's something I take, you know, a great deal of pride in and work very hard at. To without giving up any of the vigor of the debate, you see, to try to build the relationship. Now, that's in part because I believe it's the right thing to do. It's the Christian thing to do. It's what Jesus would recommend, I'm sure, although he's a pretty vigorous debater himself. Also, it's strategic. As I like to say, when I debate these folks, I do not debate to embarrass anybody. I don't even really want to win. What I want to do is advance the argument, advance the cause, and a win to me is not somebody going away saying, boy, was that a clever lawyer, you know, with all the tricks, like you know, that trick that that guy played at Irvine. I want them to say, this is more interesting than I thought it was going to be. You know, this is fun. Everybody told me it would just be a barrage of insults, and we actually had a good time, and you know, and we had an interesting discussion. Let's do this again. See, now, I've gone to the University of Texas, another place I've been very welcome, and twice I've had debates with Steven Weinberg, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist, one of the most famous scientists in the world, and a bear of a debater, and a very self-confident guy, and very atheistic. And he came back a second time. I'm hoping, you know, he's going to do it a third time when I go back there, if he will, you know, and does and gets engaged in that way. See, that's what I really want to happen, and you can see why. You see, that's what legitimates the issue as something you can discuss in the academic world, which is my goal. You know, if they'd go away saying, you know, this is a really interesting issue, we got to find somebody that's a better debater than that Phil Johnson, that's what I want them to say. You know, because the point is to make it an interesting issue, not to show that I can make arguments. Yes?
If I can summarize, it seems like what you're saying is your key question is, shall we follow the facts or the philosophy? And
yes.
I think I don't know that much about trial law, but from what I've heard, you never ask a question before you actually know the answer ahead of time.
Sure.
All right, so you're confident that the facts are leading away from the naturalistic, materialistic.
Yes.
And so far in your talk, you've given two, the fossil record and the black box. Are there others?
All the way. I talked about the embryology, too, you know, which I think is the most important thing because it's going to show that there really is no mechanism for transformation even when you bring intelligence to bear, you know, say, let alone unintelligent. But this is, you know, requires a lot of time to go into in any detail. Let me just say that in terms of that knowing the answer and so on, I believe that it's useful to make this kind of a change in the terms of the argument and raise the questions even if you don't know the answer. Now, see, some timid people, again, in the theistic evolution camp will say, well, you're leading us into a disaster because you open up the debate in this way. Maybe they'll show they really do have a mechanism. You see, maybe they'll fill all the gaps. Maybe they'll have something new. And my view of that straightforwardly is if that is the case, so be it. You see, then that is an advance to the truth, and we should have no fear of accepting that risk. Now, I can also assure you I'm not in the slightest bit worried that that's going to happen, because if they could do it, they would have done it already. I mean, I know what the literature is and what they've done, and they're not going to succeed in doing that. But I want to say, you know, that although I do have a Christian apologetic purpose, you know, and a Christian faith and so on, and that I'm very upfront about that, I believe this would be, you know, worth doing for its own sake in terms of the advancement of knowledge and of truth, even if it had no, you know, effect on the religious situation, people's religious beliefs or whatever. I'm, you know, a participant in the teaching and learning and truth-seeking enterprise, not a salesman.
Ben. I'm very appreciative of your helping us frame a strategy for the dialogue and for the debate. And I've been around this enough myself to know that there are times when someone hears, oh, there's a law professor at the University of California, Berkeley, who's critiquing mechanistic naturalism, how interesting, and they want to hear. And then they hear, oh, he's a Presbyterian elder, and he's publishing with InterVarsity Press and Evangelical Press, and so the discussion ceases. And I was in a discussion with some others about Michael Behe's work, and they said, oh, don't you know Michael Behe's a Catholic? And so, as you said, the mind kind of slams shut. So, well, all of us, that is most of us in this room, are kind of outed already. We're in a theological seminary, and we come with identification with an evangelical faith community. So what's the most important thing that we can do in terms of strategy? How can we engage this debate already being identified as Bible-believing Christians?
You know, when I took this up, I was... I got a lot of advice on the question of how upfront to be about, you know, my religious standpoint and all of that. The general advice was, you know, cool it, deny it, you know, sort of, or whatever. Well, I, of course, didn't take any of that advice You should not tell a lie, especially when you can't get away with it anyway. That sounds very White House-ish, doesn't it? There's a moral position for you, you know. I felt that, of course, it's very important to acknowledge this. And I've also unashamedly used the word creationist. And many people said, stay away from that word, you know, because it has all these negative connotations and this and so on. I said, well, creation is just too good a word to give away. We've got to take it back. And, you know, so I'm just going to do that and pay the cost and not look back, because we have to do that. One of the things I do, by the way, talk show, I do hundreds of talk shows, of course, and a talk show host will call up and say, we want you to talk about evolution versus creationism. You know what I say immediately? No, you can't phrase it that way. Evolution versus creation, or evolutionism versus creationism. See, that's the first trap. Evolution versus creationism is the fact of evolution versus the ism of creation. Don't ever debate that. You've already lost. It's over. You say that. I will compromise, and we can accept evolutionism versus creation. Now, that'd be okay with that. What I do think what's important is to get the confidence. You know, it doesn't matter what people say about you. Say you're praying. They always say this. They say that about each other. You know, Daniel Dennett suggested that Stephen Jay Gould is the secret belief in God, and that's why it's utterly absurd. You know, so just don't worry about that sort of thing. Just go straightforwardly on, and don't let it shake your confidence. That's the biggest thing. When I first got into this battle, the people on the creation side, the group that I recruited, you know, they were debating and they were making points and so on, but they were always apologetic, you see, always trying to somehow persuade the scientific establishment of their good faith. If we do the right things, they'll accept us. And of course, they never would. When we had our first big academic confrontation in a symposium at SMU several years ago, when people came up afterwards and they said, that's the biggest thing that's changed since you came in here. There's no more bowing and scraping. You say, we meet it with confidence. We have the high intellectual ground. So I don't think you should, you know, lose a moment's worry about that. Just go right ahead. Be proud of what you are. You know, be intellectually honest and objective about assessing the evidence, and just tell people, well, you know, the idea that atheism is the unbiased position, or that agnosticism is the reasonable middle position between atheism and theism, is just ridiculous, and we're not buying that. Just tell them where to get off.
Last summer, the Pope, in what some regard as infallibility, announced that evolution was an established fact, and that we should not consider that an issue anymore. How has that affected your speeches with the Catholic and the Christian community at large?
I discussed the Pope's statement in Chapter 6 of Defeating Darwinism by Opening Minds. The Pope took a position, I think it was very mistimed and unfortunate, but it's not as bad as it seemed. He said that materialistic theories of evolution, and in the middle of the statement he said, materialistic theories of evolution, which imagine that the spirit of man is the product of matter, are contrary to reality. You see, and since the materialistic theory of evolution is the only one there is, they could have headlined it, Pope defies evolution. You know, you've got to rearrange that, and it would come out the other, sounding the other way. But the Pope did take a position which is the most common one in the Catholic hierarchy and has been taken before, which is that we don't care about evolution, materialistic or otherwise, all the way up to the spirit, the soul, the spirit of man, and God has to intervene directly to do this. You see, and so that gives the church something to do. I mean, you know, it gives it some ontological territory, you might say. But I regard this as, you know, you see, that's just a forced compromise of incompatible ways of thinking. It's a bad intellectual position, and we're working with Catholic thinkers as well as others to try to improve this. Overall, it didn't have a bad effect because it got it in the paper.